tomorrow. Stories of Our Times is changing.
We'll have a new name, The Story. If you see The Story in your feed, that's us.
We'll still be telling one remarkable story in depth each day.
We won't have vanished. Our name is just changing. Fear not. So look out for The Story in your podcast feed.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
It's astonishingly common. In fact, it's the most common form of child sexual abuse within the family. Even by the most conservative estimates, more than 1 million people across the country will have experienced it. And hundreds of thousands of children could be experiencing it right now. And yet, nobody ever talks about it.
It's harder not talking about it than talking about it. And I didn't realise that until I waived my anonymity. The option of waiving my anonymity or going back to being silent again wasn't an option. So you have all your choices taken away when you're a victim of child sexual abuse.
That's Liz Roberts, a lovely, warm, well-dressed woman in her early 60s. You probably know someone just like her. But what she went through as a child at the hands of her brother was horrific. She's lived with it for years and is only now able to talk about it openly. And in honour of people like her who've had to hide their experiences in the shadows for years, there will be no hiding on this podcast. Some of what you'll hear is very explicit and difficult to listen to. And if you think that might be too much for you, then you might want to turn off now and come and find us again tomorrow. But sibling sexual abuse has been hidden away and ignored by society for far too long. We won't shy away from confronting it. For Liz, it began when she was very young.
8 years old, seven, 8 years old. You're probably expecting me to say, well, what do you remember? What do you physically remember? I can't remember getting undressed, but I can remember the feeling of being undressed and the total exposure and the total helplessness and terror of the feelings of being undressed.
When it's your own brother abusing you, who do you tell? How does it affect the rest of the family? The fear stops many people from saying anything for decades until the trauma finally erupts.
Without exception, every one of the people I spoke to had been abused as children by their siblings. Even though, in many cases, disclosure had wreaked havoc within the family, relations within the family had broken down, the thing they all said was that it wasn't until they began talking about what happened to them that they began to get better.
You're listening to Stories of Our Times from The Times and The Sunday Times. I'm Manveen Rana. Today, sibling sexual abuse. The unspeakable crime.
My name's Decca Aikenhead, and I'm chief interviewer for the Sunday Times.
Decca, how did you first hear about sibling sexual abuse?
I mean, I ran into it completely by accident. I was abroad, and it was a hot night, and I was trying to get to sleep. And like all middle-aged people, I thought BBC Sounds would be the solution. And I just kind of clicked on a few downloads and thought, oh, I'll listen to the latest File on 4.
I have a podcast to recommend.
Exactly. I thought, I'll just listen to File on 4. I'm sure that'll send me to sleep. And I lay there in the dark with my eyes absolutely wide open, listening to a documentary about sibling sexual abuse and learning that it was by far the most common form of child sexual abuse within the family, quite possibly the most common form of child sexual abuse at all.
I mean, that's astonishing.
Quite. I thought, but I don't understand this. I've been a journalist for a very long time. We write about child sexual abuse all the time. You know, this is something that we've covered extensively, from the Catholic Church scandal to Rotherham.
Yeah.
How can this possibly be? And I also then assumed, my God, well, this will be all over the papers by tomorrow. You know, of course, what extraordinary. The documentary had been triggered by a recent piece, a huge piece of research, which was illustrating quite how prevalent it was. And I thought, well, this will make headlines. And then I read the papers the next day and the next day, and I thought, how absolutely weird. There's nothing here. And I was so puzzled and my interest was so piqued that I contacted the woman who had led the research project, which had been reported on in this documentary. And she went, oh, Decca, I'm not remotely surprised. I wasn't expecting any coverage. And I said, well, why ever not? And she just sort of sighed and she said, it's the ick factor.
The ick factor.
Ick factor, yeah. She said, people just cannot bear to think about this subject. It's so disturbing. It's so upsetting. Journalists don't like to cover it because there's no obvious kind of goody and baddie. It doesn't fit within the kind of tabloid narrative about childhood sexual abuse. There's also no institution to be blamed. And people would simply rather not think about it. And that was the beginning of me taking an interest in this. And that theme I saw recur over and over and over again. And of course, right down to within the families in which it's taking place. It's so upsetting that even when it's disclosed, parents just can't bear to think about it. And so they tell themselves it's not true, it's not happening. Or, oh, it's just doctors and nurses, it's no big deal. This theme of people not wanting to look at it is so embedded in the story of sibling sexual abuse. And of course, being a journalist, that made me want to cover it.
Just give us, for the record, a definition of what counts as sibling sexual abuse.
The definitions vary, but one of the most commonly used one was by an American professor, a psychologist, who said it's sexual acts initiated by one sibling towards another without the other's consent by use of force or coercion, or crucially, that's my word, where there is a power differential between the siblings. Now, I think anybody listening to this who has children will know that the power differential of age, of order in the family, even if the age gap is very small, is extraordinary amongst siblings. And through dint of nothing other than being older, a sibling has a power over their younger sibling, which is almost limitless. And that theme, it is almost always an older sibling. And the sexual acts don't necessarily involve penetration, although the most common form of SSA that was recorded by the police in 2022, the most recent figures, was rape.
Really?
But what's very important to be clear about is that this is not doctors and nurses. If you think of sort of sexual activity between siblings as a kind of continuum, you have at one end of the spectrum entirely normal developmental curiosity. And this is not to be confused with that. And sibling sexual abuse is something very different. And most of the women who I interviewed had been raped by their brothers. If it didn't involve rape, it certainly involved oral sex. It's not doctors and nurses.
Just give us a sense, how common is it and, you know, how does it play out?
Different studies have come up with different figures, chiefly because it's such an undisclosed, unreported sexual offence. They compile data from taking, for example, randomised studies of adults and just asking one of the questions, were you ever sexually abused as a child? If so, was it by a family member? If so, which family member? And when you study the question from that direction, as opposed to relying upon, say, police statistics, that's when you discover that it's between 3 and 5 times more common than father-daughter, or father-child, rather, or stepfather-child. Another feature is that the abuse tends to go on for much longer. A child abused by a sibling tends to be abused for an average 5 years. And the children are much younger than children abused by adults. It typically begins when they're about between five and seven. Rape Crisis conducted the biggest study that's been conducted in the world, and they've concluded that about 5% of children in Britain are involved in sibling sexual abuse. So the numbers are colossal. I interviewed one woman whose brother abused her for many years, and she was in her 40s before she understood that it wasn't so normal that that wasn't the reason why she'd never heard anybody talking about it. She thought, oh, nobody ever mentions it because it's just so common as muck.
Wow. She just thought this is what happens when you grow up.
Yes, exactly. And in fact, she went off to boarding school when she was 9. The abuse, I think, took place between about the age of 6 and 9. And then she went off to boarding school. And when she was a teenager at an all-girls boarding school, she was in a dormitory one night with 2 girls. And she said they got to that age where everyone's obsessed with boys and obsessed with sex. And they were talking about various sort of things that somebody might or might have done. And she said completely casually and rather blasé, not realising what she was saying, she said, oh, gosh, I mean, I've done 69ers.
Oh, wow.
And the 2 girls turned at her and stared with their eyes popping out of their heads. What are you talking about? Who? When? And she said, when I was younger with a boy who was 9. And they just rolled their eyes at her. And said, oh, don't be ridiculous. Stop lying. And she said that was the moment when she thought, oh, maybe it's not okay to talk about this. Maybe everybody doesn't do this. And yet she still managed to tell herself that maybe everyone just doesn't. They just don't talk about it. And it wasn't until she was in her 40s, and by that point had exhibited so many of the classic psychological consequences of this and was in a terrible place, that she then read about sibling sexual abuse and everything began to fall into place.
Just so shocking and unexpected. Deckard, tell me about Liz Roberts. How did you come across her?
Oh, Liz Roberts is a very unusual and interesting woman. And what makes her so unusual is that she waived her right to anonymity. And that's why I became aware of her. She grew up in Bristol and was the daughter of a police constable. Very Catholic family.
We were the model Catholic family. My father was a police officer and ended up his career as a detective chief inspector, so a senior police officer. My mum was a housewife. There were 5 kids. Good Catholic family, hardworking. 3 of the 5 of us went to grammar school. Behind closed doors, totally different kettle of fish. I've often described my mum as the toxic glue that held the family together. So she would set us against each other, so nowhere to go, nowhere to feel safe. But to the outside looking in, yeah, we were the sort of jewel in the Catholic crown, if you like, of the neighbourhood that I grew up in.
You were 7 or 8 years old. You had other siblings, and you had a brother, Andrew. How old was he at the time?
He was 8 years older than me, so he was, sort of, well, 15, 16. It was back in the 70s, so he was a man. And my memories of him are of a man. His body was that of a man. He was a developed male. He'd left school, so he was an apprentice. So it wasn't like a schoolboy. You know, he had his own bedroom. He was the only one of us that had his own bedroom because he was the grown-up. A lot older than me. And often, yeah, left in charge.
Left in charge of the children?
Well, left in charge of me. I'd say I don't remember where my youngest brother was. My youngest brother was 4 years younger than me, so that would have put him at 4. So the times when the house was empty. He would possibly be with my parents. You know, you don't remember. I just remember the feelings of dread when mum and dad would say, well, we're going off to visit so-and-so, we're going off to do A, B and C. And I'd have this feeling. And Andrew would sidle up to me and he had a code word that he would use. And he would say TW, which stood for Tickle Willies. So obviously it went on for long enough for him to say that and then turn it into, to abbreviate it into a code word. And interestingly, I don't remember how it actually started. I don't remember the first time, but he exploited my love of horses to play the thing called bucking broncos. So I apparently he would let me ride on his back, and in return I had to do these horrendous things to him, and he would do these even worse things to me.
I don't want to have to take you back to some really unpleasant experiences. So honestly, feel free to say as much or as little as you feel comfortable saying. I know none of this is easy. Tell us anything you want to about what you had to go through at the age of eight. Eight. A child.
Do you really want to know?
Whatever you want to tell.
Well, I can remember having to hold his penis in my hand and masturbate him. And I can remember the taste and the smell and the sensation and everything to do with that. I can remember physical pain. I can remember the feeling of him on top of me. And these are real feelings and these are real memories. And that's pretty disgusting.
What Liz went through at the age of eight is horrifying. But when it's your own sibling sexually abusing you, how do you tell your parents? That's coming up in just a moment. Before that, just a quick reminder. From tomorrow, you'll see a different name in your podcast feed. Stories of Our Times will become The Story. It'll still be the same brilliant journalism and storytelling, but with a new title. So look out for us as The Story wherever you get your podcasts.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And Deckard, given that, you know, there is that spectrum and people explore on the one end and then you get the sibling sexual abuse, you get the idea that people might just sort of be putting it down to playing doctors and nurses. Does all of that contribute to why it's so difficult for people to report it? You know, if a child goes to a parent, I mean, what's the sort of reception you get?
Well, many, many, many children don't ever tell their parent, because the fear that they will be destroying the family, the fear that they will be disbelieved,
the fear that their sibling, who, although it's an emotionally complicated thing, often they both hate the abuse but love their sibling, and they are terrified of the consequences of exposing what's going on. So the average age at which most people who've experienced sibling sexual abuse first disclose, if ever, is 40.
40?
40. Then obviously for parents, it's so devastating. I interviewed one woman who, when she was in her early 30s, sat her parents down and told them that from the age, by memory, I think she was from 8 to 11, her brother had crept into her bedroom at night and raped her regularly. When she told her parents that, they were weeks away from their 40th wedding anniversary. And she said, if you could hear a heartbreak, you'd have heard it. And the marriage collapsed. So it's very, very, very difficult for parents to hear and accept. It's very difficult for parents to know what to do. And the silence becomes self-perpetuating because parents have never often heard of it before when they're told about it. So either they think this thing just can't be possible, it can't be true, or they think, oh my God, we are the only family that this has ever happened in. And they are so paralyzed by shame that they don't report or seek help.
I told my parents about it when I was in my 20s. So I went to my parents' home and standing in the kitchen, and I just blurted it out. I didn't articulate it at all. And they sort of stopped in their tracks and looked at me and they said, are you sure? Surely not. You didn't mean that. But then they knew that I wasn't a child to do that. I was so straight. It was frightening. You know, I wasn't a liar. And they really very quickly realised that actually, yeah. And that was it. Actually, no, what they said was, well, it was just kids messing around, wasn't it?
Kids messing around.
And I just felt this volcano. And I said, I knew you'd say that. And I said, he's 8 years older than me. And I stormed off. And I went back to my house that was about 2 miles away from the family home. And when I got back, the phone was ringing. This was the time when you actually had phones that plugged in the wall, you know. And I knew it would be my parents. And they said, well, we do believe you. But that was it. They didn't ask how serious it was, what he'd done. And it was never alluded to ever again after that. Bearing in mind my dad was head of the murder squad, there was not even any professional curiosity about this.
Did you want to tell them how serious it was?
I don't think they wanted to know. So no, because I didn't. I think they would have felt that because on the surface I was coping, it's easy for parents to think, well, I don't need to do anything because everything appears to be fine.
Another reason why there's such silence around this is that unless the sibling who harmed them is taken to court and convicted of the offence, if they are to start talking publicly about it, they put themselves at risk of being sued for defamation by the sibling. And because it's such a difficult crime to prosecute, even when it's contemporary, to get a prosecution decades later, well, you can imagine how difficult that is. We all know how difficult it is to get a conviction for any kind of sexual offence. So imagine how difficult this one is. And in the absence of that conviction, it's impossible for them to speak publicly. And I spoke to one woman who was desperate to be able to be on the record, desperate to be able to give the full details of her story. But were she to do so and the brother she was talking about be identified, well, that would put her at risk of a liability for defamation. So that inhibited the extent to which we could tell people's stories. And it was a very frustrating aspect of this whole story for me, because, of course, I wanted to be able to.
For Liz, things came to a head when her mother died a few years after her father.
It was Mother's Day, the day after Mother's Day that she died. It was the first day of lockdown in 2020. And that's really the day my life changed.
Andrew, the older brother who'd abused her, was now the executor of the will and was getting in touch regularly about their parents' estate. And all of this happened just as Liz was undergoing therapy for the abuse that she'd suffered as a child.
So then the emails start and the WhatsApp group, we'd never had a WhatsApp group before, you know, and I'm trying to get my head sorted, and all the time I'm getting pinging emails from the person I don't want to even think about. And these are all legitimate emails, there's nothing malicious about them. It was just, what should we do about the house? And I just couldn't function. So in the end, I decided that I'd get him out of my life, and I wrote him a letter, it was 5 pages long. And at the bottom of it, I said, I just asked one thing, and that is that you never contact me again. I don't ever want to see or hear from you ever again. And I also wrote a letter to my other siblings. I didn't give them the detail because I was so scared of getting into trouble. So I just wrote and said, look, I'm done. I said to my other brother, could you please let me know anything I need to sign legally from the will point of view? But I'm done. I expected my other brothers to say, okay, shut the door on your way out, because I didn't really have a relationship with them. But they showed the curiosity that my parents didn't, and started to sort of dig around into this and what's gone on with Liz. It must be pretty serious, blah, blah, blah. And Andrew, being a narcissist, I suppose, and not being able to let someone else have the last word, having to keep some sort of control because he didn't know what I'd said to my brothers. He didn't know what I was going to do with this information. Protecting himself, broke back. Totally disregarded my threat of going to the police. If you contact me again, I might go to the police. Had no intention of doing that. I didn't ever think the police would ever believe me. But he totally ignored that and sent me an email. And this email contained a very watered-down partial confession, admitting that he had done certain acts to me. There were about 5 lines on this letter about what he'd done, or what he thinks he did. And the rest was about him, page after page of how bad his life was and what happened to him and this. And it was just unbelievable. I realised I've actually got evidence. I've got something. He's admitted something, which is more than most people ever have. So that I've no choice, that I went to the police.
What happened then? What happens when you go to the police with something which is historic that you don't have very much evidence over, but you do have this amazing email?
What do you think happened? What do you think they did? What would you expect them to do?
Well, you'd hope they opened an investigation.
Well, they did. The first officer I spoke to, the first thing he said to me, I want to tell you that I'm really, really sorry this has happened to you, and I believe every word you've told me. And it was absolutely unbelievable. And they opened a full investigation. I watched my two brothers. They sat in through the actual trial itself. They watched it. It was devastating for them. But the irony is now I have brothers that I didn't have before.
Another reason for the kind of silence surrounding this is that sometimes the media do report court cases of sibling sexual abuse. But because every victim of a sexual offence has a right to anonymity when the case goes to court, as a journalist, I could sit in court and cover a case, say a prosecution of a man in his 30s who used to rape his sister when he was a child, and he's prosecuted, and I can sit there in court and write everything down, and he's convicted and he's sentenced, and I can write that this man was convicted of raping a child when he was 15, and I can write about what he was sentenced to. But I can't write that the victim was his sibling, because siblings are such a small and identifiable pool once you've named the offender, that compromises the victim's anonymity. So many people listening to this podcast probably will have read a story in the papers about a man who was found guilty and convicted of a sibling sexual abuse, but they won't know that it was sibling sexual abuse because the journalist wasn't allowed to say so.
And just tell us, what happened to Andrew after the trial? What's happening to him now?
So he's got a tag, which for another 4 months.
This is an ankle tag.
Yeah, which is actually, ironically, quite a good thing, because my brother likes to think of himself as a big fish in a small pond, and now that small pond knows what he's done. But because of the age of him at the time and how long ago it was, he had to be sentenced according to the law at the time. Had he been convicted of rape at the time, he would have got minimal sentence. But as it currently stood, with the convictions that he got, he would have got 3 months in a youth detention centre. And because he pleaded guilty, he would have probably got less than 1 week, kind of thing. So what the judge did...
Oh, that's shocking.
Yeah, I know. But what the judge did was, I believe, did an amazing job. When I was giving my evidence and when I read my victim personal statement out in court, I absolutely believe he was listening to every single word. And I know that he saw everything that happened in that courtroom. I absolutely have total faith in that. And I think he did everything he could to deliver as much punishment as he could to Andrew within the limits of what he could do.
Is there much help for people if they've been through this? You know, and the authorities, do they know how to deal with cases of sibling sexual abuse when people come forward?
This is another terrible aspect of the case. Because it, until recently, didn't even have a name, sibling sexual abuse is a relatively recently recognised term, but there are no national guidelines. There are no policies in place. If you as a parent were to discover that your son was abusing his sister, there is no specialist team in this country that's fully trained, a statutory service that can intervene and help. So the support or the intervention you will get will vary entirely depending on where you live, which particular social worker you may come in contact with. There are increasingly, and this is a very new development in the last few years, there are now amazing charities offering support and resources. And there are now websites that you can go to which will refer you to therapists who now work specifically in this field. In fact, one of them has just written a very, very good book. So there is now a patchwork of all kinds of largely either private therapy or charitable support services. What we don't have is any kind of systematic, trained, statutory response to this problem.
With all of these charities, is that helping people to talk about it more, though? Because that's presumably the first step to getting the authorities to change.
And also for people themselves to just talk, because many of the women I spoke to thought they were the only ones. Mm. And I also observed an interesting kind of dichotomy, which recurred in many of their stories, which is that they knew, you know, as very young children when it began, they knew it was wrong. And they knew it was damaging, and they knew it wasn't normal. And yet simultaneously, they kind of reassured themselves that it was no big deal and it was normal and it was fine. There's a really interesting coping mechanism, psychological coping mechanism, the consequence of which was always silence, always. And like everything, when nobody talks about something, nobody else talks about something. So I think what we're witnessing just really in the last 5 years is this sudden beginning of a conversation. And so now, if this is something that's happened to you and you go online and you type in sibling sexual abuse, you will very, very quickly realise you are far from the only one. And of course, that emboldens people to then reach out and speak. 10 years ago, if you'd Googled sibling sexual abuse, you might have found a couple of slightly arcane, obscure academic documents, but you wouldn't have found any of these resources, and you wouldn't have found this community of women that made you understand that you were not the only one. And one of the women I interviewed said very powerfully, God, if I could have read about this 20 years ago, if there had been people writing articles like this 20 years ago, I wouldn't have had to spend the last 20 years feeling awful about myself and letting people walk all over me and thinking it was completely normal for all women to feel shit about themselves. And I wouldn't have had to not know why I felt that way.
It's absolutely tragic to think as we're speaking now, it's happening. And it will continue to happen. But there's also like an underground movement now of survivors that are finding their voice. And they can't all do what I'm doing because they haven't had the criminal justice side of things that enables them to name that person as the person who's at fault here, not me. It puts a lot of responsibility on me to get this right and give the right message on behalf of them as well. But absolutely, because I know that I thought it was just me. I thought I was going mad. I thought I was weak, stupid, unloved and unlovable. And I absolutely believed that until 4 years ago. That's crazy, isn't it?
Completely mad.
But it's true. Why am I mad?
No, but that, like, it's so unreasonable to believe that. And yet so many people do.
They do believe it because that's the child in them is telling that. Because you must be bad because your parents, when they know about it, don't care about it or they don't want to deal with it properly. You've actually not done anything about it, so it can't have been that bad, but it can be stopped or it can be addressed by things like you're doing today.
I hope so. And Decca, for you, you know, in writing this piece and in investigating it, you know, you talked at the start about the ick factor that stopped people covering it. Was it quite harrowing, though? I mean, has it been quite hard doing this investigation?
It's funny, you know, the answer should be yes, shouldn't it, you'd think. But I'll tell you why it wasn't. It was extremely emotionally raw and emotionally intense. And it was not easy to listen to these horrifying stories. But the reason why it wasn't, I think, is because without exception, every one of the people I spoke to who'd been abused as children by their siblings, even though in many cases disclosure had wreaked havoc within the family, relations within the family had broken down, you know, it had not come without a very high cost, disclosure. The thing they all said was that it wasn't until they began talking about what happened to them that they began to get better. That's when they felt that their lives began. That's when they felt that they began to inhabit themselves and their bodies, and they began to feel that they had a future.
If I hadn't done it, I'd have reverted to who I was and how I coped with things. And now it's like you feel like anything's possible. And you look forward, I was looking forward, excited to see you today. I'm hoping that there'll be some good response. I'm sure that I will have upset a few people. And I don't want to upset people, but I want to challenge people. I think there are a lot of people like me that don't get the opportunity to speak publicly. And that's lulls society into a sense of denial that it's happening, that it's not important.
And for you now, you know, this is more than 50 years since the abuse happened. You've had a trial. How are you now?
I'm pretty good. Yeah, I'm pretty good. I think you get black days and you beat yourself up a lot. I do. I worry about not being good enough. You know, I worry about, I just want to do more than I'm doing now, I think. I understand my limitations now. I'm better at setting boundaries. I'm less of a people pleaser, which is really important.
And Decca, do you have any great hope for what this article might achieve? I mean, you're sending it out into the world. What are you hoping the ripples will do?
Oh, Manveen, it's a very rare thing in journalism to really get an opportunity to write something that I hope will have a real impact on individual people's lives. You know, most of the time I interview famous people and that's a fantastic job and I love it, but it's not analogous to this. So I just feel incredibly grateful to all of the people who spoke to me because it's not an easy thing to talk about publicly. Of course it isn't. You know, for most people, it's not an easy thing to talk about privately, and many, as I say, never do. But it just felt like such a privilege to be able to put this out in the open because one of the themes people kept discussing was one woman said, everyone likes a villain in a story.
And there aren't any villains in this story because they're all children. She said the real villain of sibling sexual abuse is stigma. And I thought that was such a powerful way of putting it. Most of all, though, Manveen, what I really just hope is that some people pick up the newspaper and read this article and think, oh my God, I'm not the only one. And oh my God, that's why I've been anorexic, or that's why I'm depressed, or that's why. And I hope just at a very individual level, even if all it does is make sense for them in themselves, even if they never pick up the phone and ask for support. And I also hope that parents read it and don't think, well, that would never happen in our family. I hope they will read it and think, God, that could happen in our family. And let's just think about this and let's just make some sensible steps to make sure that it doesn't.
You've been listening for the last time to Stories of Our Times from The Times and The Sunday Times with me, Manveen Rana, and my guests, Chief Interviewer for The Sunday Times, Decca Aitkenhead, and Liz Roberts, a survivor of sibling sexual abuse. If you want to know more about the subject, do read Decca's brilliant, in-depth report in The Sunday Times, which you can find online with a subscription. And if you've been affected by anything we've covered today, then you can find more information and support from the Sibling Sexual Abuse Resource Centre, ssarc.co.uk. The producer today was Edward Drummond. The executive producer was Fiona Leach, and sound design was by Mal Lasseto. We'll be back tomorrow with a new name.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.